a minute and set our motivation. And recall all those unfindable sentient beings for whose benefit we are practicing the Dharma and for whose benefit we want to attain full enlightenment. Okay. So, you gotta ask the questions for me to answer them, or try to answer them. So, what have you been thinking about? Yeah.
I had a question that I started with Guy at lunchtime. He mentioned the contradiction that the meditator feels between emptiness and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking about that. How does that work? And he said, well, everything disappears in emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering what the working definition of compassion is then. Do you have to have an object? Do you have to have a self acting on an object in order to have compassion? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, compassion, the definition in the tradition, is the wish for someone to be free of suffering.
Right.
Okay? So it is a mind. Yeah, it is a mind. It has an object, which are sentient beings, and then the aspect of the object is seeing them as suffering, and so you want to alleviate their suffering.
So within that strict definition,
uh-huh,
that logic is understood, but I'm thinking of the people with deluded awareness.
People with what?
Deluded
awareness. Right? Yeah.
When they're in the presence of mirror mind, they experience that as compassionate. They have a sense of it that you could describe as compassion, even though there's no self there acting on that wish in a conscious way.
I'm not sure I understand. So when people have mirror mind?
No, when they're in the presence of
mirror mind
is
what does
one
that
definition
mean?
Of the ultimate, right? It's a description of it.
No.
Well, I've read that.
Not in the tradition that we follow.
Yeah. Well, it's one. All right, we'll find some different language for it.
Uh-huh. Because the ultimate in the tradition is the deeper mode in which things exist.
Right.
Okay, so when we investigate in what Guy was saying, how does this really exist?
Mm-hmm.
What is it really? Not what does it just appear to me to be, but what is it really when I investigate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what we find with that analysis is that we can't find anything to put a circle around and say, that is the thing.
Right.
Okay, so what's appearing is the emptiness of true existence. To that mind that's perceiving that ultimate nature, okay, directly, only emptiness appears to that mind because it's a non-dual experience, whereas compassion is a dual experience.
Well, I'm
perceiving a sentient being.
Of that non-dual awareness.
What do you mean in the presence of that?
If you were in the presence of someone in that state with that awareness.
Oh, but that's their mental state. That doesn't mean I experience it. It can be in a room with people who are suffering. I don't experience the suffering.
People who are in the presence of the Buddha, depending on, as you say, their own minds, experience something.
They might experience strong faith in the Buddha, or they may really be inspired to meditate on the Buddha's teachings, but that's what's going on in their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what the Buddha realizes doesn't get transferred to sentient beings' minds when they're in the presence of the Buddha.
What I'm saying is that a person in non-dual awareness,
mm-hmm,
that presence, other people experience the acceptance, the spaciousness of it, they experience a qualitative difference, depending on their own sensitivity, I suppose.
Well, they may, but see, somebody can realize non-dual awareness, but that doesn't mean that all the time they're having direct perception of it. Because somebody, when they meditate on emptiness, if we're talking about a high-level being, an Arya, when they have meditation sessions, then they go into single-pointed concentration on emptiness. And at that time, only emptiness appears to their mind. When they come out of their meditation in post-meditation time, and they're walking around, okay, they're not directly perceiving emptiness at that time. Their mind is not in a non-dual awareness state at that time because their senses are functioning, they're talking with people, so they're working at that time in a conventional way.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're with, let's say, His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, who has realized emptiness, when we're with him, he's not directly perceiving emptiness at that time unless he's in intense meditation, or if he really, you know, if he's really a Buddha, then only the Buddha can perceive the two truths at the same time. But otherwise, if we say, okay, he's...
So you would not be able to call that compassion, is what you're telling me. The experience of the spaciousness of those minds.
No, you would say that when somebody's in meditative equipoise on emptiness, that realization is supported by compassion because compassion was part of the motivation that led them to do that meditation. But at that time when they're having direct realization of emptiness, nothing else appears to the mind except emptiness. And they're not thinking anything, you know? And so other people in the room, if I'm, you know, if somebody's in meditative equipoise on emptiness, sitting there, and I come in the room, I might be very inspired, just, you know, if I'm any sensitive at all, or I might just say, what's that guy doing looking at his belly button, you know, which is what many people do when they see people meditating. What are you looking at your belly button for so long, you know? So people get all sorts of different experiences when they're around highly realized beings, according to their own level of mind.
What you're talking about is the karma of the other person?
No. Well, I understand the logic of what you're saying completely. There's no confusion there. But but experientially, I was, that word compassion sit for me as a qualitative quality. You know. So that's what I was asking now.
It seems there was a conversation after lunch, and I heard a little bit about how some schools, maybe even the Theravada, would tend towards the wisdom path and study emptiness and hoping that that leads to compassionate thought.
So it's kind of, you know, does realizing emptiness automatically lead you to compassion? Actually, and it doesn't matter here whether you're Theravada or Mahayana, okay? But compassion is actually cultivated separately from the wisdom realizing emptiness. Yeah, because when you're using, there are different kinds of meditations with the meditation on emptiness, you're trying to realize an object, which is emptiness. But of course, don't think of it as a truly existent object. Like we were talking this morning, okay, it's not truly existent. But you're trying to understand that object. Whereas in the meditation of compassion, you're trying to transform your mind into the nature of compassion. You're not trying to understand a particular object. So there, it's different ways of meditating. Okay, and so compassion is a type of meditation that you do that's cultivated separately from the wisdom realizing emptiness, although certainly those two meditations reinforce each other and help each other, because if you have strong compassion that leads you to generate bodhicitta, then that's going to intensify your energy and effort to realize emptiness. And if you have an understanding of emptiness, that's going to really help your compassion and your bodhicitta, because you'll see that it's possible to eliminate suffering, that suffering isn't a definite thing that has to be. So those two meditations help each other, but they're done separately. Okay, does that make some sense?
Yep. Yes. I guess my question was a bit more about the schools.
Okay.
As far as some schools and the Buddha teaching, you know, more of the wisdom aspects and not great compassion, for instance, and how that seems to be tipped toward the wisdom part, but hopefully then compassion or great compassion will be introduced later along.
Okay. Well, you know, I find that that in the West we have a lot of misconceptions. Well, not only in the West, in Asia too. People have incredible misconceptions about other Buddhist traditions. And so one of the popular Mahayana misconceptions of Theravada is those people don't have any compassion. They just meditate on wisdom. They don't have any compassion. but actually, if you look at the Theravada teachings, there's a whole teaching on the four immeasurables, you know, cultivating love, compassion, and joy, and equanimity. And unbeknownst to the Mahayanas, there's a whole bodhisattva path laid out in the Theravada canon. In the Theravada, not in the original canon, but in the commentaries. Yeah, complete with 10 far-reaching practices, 10 perfections. Yeah. So, don't. No, there's in the 5th or 6th century, what was his name? Dhamma somebody. I should look it up. He wrote a whole text on the Bodhisattva practice from the Theravada perspective. Yeah? And so some people say that even within standard Theravada countries, there are people who could practice the Bodhisattva path. They may practice it according to the Theravada tradition, or they may actually practice it according to the Mahayana philosophical tenets too. Okay? Sometimes I think, we Mahayanists are a little bit like, you know, we got a corner on compassion. And and I don't think we can actually say that, you know, whether we're compassionate or not depends upon us as individuals, not on the tradition per se. Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard for me to think about the idea of, like, well, what does exist? I don't know. So, matter and energy, let's just speak of matter and energy. I'm not a scientist, so I get it quite right. But, I mean, we would be in a kind of, and again, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but it seems like we would be in a sort of a mind-only type of point of view to say there is no matter energy, it's all mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's the perspective of the Prasadika.
Mm-hmm.
So there is matter and energy.
Mm-hmm.
But what? And of course, the scientists keep breaking down, and we feel probably pretty certain that we're going to get to something ultimate. But, but what is there?
What appears to the mind?
But what's
falsely
the basis of what's appearing to the mind?
Emptiness.
So then you're all mind.
No. Saying it's empty doesn't mean it is all mind. Saying it's empty means that there's nothing that exists objectively from its own side able to set itself up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Something is the basis of what's appearing.
Oh, are you looking for some tiniest particle?
Well, I don't want to be.
Well, see, this is our grasping mind. We want something that's ultimately findable, that's out there, you know, concrete, objective, real, that's the basis of everything. Okay? So this is our grasping mind. We want to find something. Okay, so we might look for, you know, the ultimate basis of matter. We might look for the ultimate consciousness that's indestructible. You know, we might posit all different kinds of things, make emptiness truly existent. You know, but we're looking for something to pin the tail of the donkey onto. Yeah, but there's nothing solid and concrete objective that exists in and of itself, unrelated to the mind. It doesn't mean everything is mind.
And that's where I have a problem.
Okay, because if you look, what's the definition of mind? Clarity and awareness. Is this table clarity and awareness?
No.
No. It's not mind. Does its existence, is this, is its existence related to mind? Yes. Okay? So its existence is related to the mind. It doesn't exist out there separately, apart from the mind that, you know, conceives and labels it. But that doesn't make it mind itself.
But then what is mind interacting with?
The table. Now you can see why, you know, we talk so often about how people get confused between mere existence and inherent existence, and they seem the same thing. This is exactly why. Because as soon as we state existence, our mind goes to inherent existence. And as soon as we say there's no inherent existence, our mind goes to nothingness. Yeah? This is, and it isn't just our problem. This is the whole problem that's been going on for people, you know, since the time the Prajnaparamita Sutras appeared on the planet, you know, and even before that. Yeah? Is we always flip-flop. And like I was saying on Thursday night, you know, that we flip-flop between absolutism and nihilism, but the absolutist and the nihilist have the same position, which is if it exists, it inherently exists, and if it doesn't exist, if it's empty, it doesn't exist at all. Okay? And so that's why finding the middle way, how it exists, but at the same time it's empty, without falling into saying, well, it's the same thing as the mind. Because it's not. The table isn't clarity and awareness.
So there is a world that's outside mind.
There's an external world, but it's not, it doesn't exist as it appears to us to exist. Because what's appearing to us is false. Because what's appearing looks like it's out there, objective. And it's hard to imagine anything, how would it exist if it isn't out there and objective? You know? We say, well, it would depend on the arise. What in the world? You know? What is perceiving something as if it were dependently arising? What would that look like? It's the same thing as, you know, we say non-dual. What in the world would perceiving something non-dually feel like? I don't know about you, but I have no clue what non-dual perception is. Because every time I think about non-dual perception, there's me understanding it. You know? So already it's dual, isn't it? Yeah?
And is this a place, that very question, a place where trying to understand relational dependence would help loosen it up a little bit? And so would you talk about relational dependence again?
Yeah. Okay, so relational dependence, you know, the part depends on the whole, is one example, but also the perceived object and the perceiving subject depend on each other. Okay? Whereas we usually think, okay, there's the object out there and there's the mind in here. It's objectively an object. The mind is objectively a subject and they smack into each other and neither one of them changes through this interaction. That's the way we conceive of it, doesn't it? You know, there's this thing out there, and my consciousness smacks into it, and nothing really changes, and the two things exist independent of each other. But how can you establish a mind perceiving a cup without having a cup? And how can you establish the existence of a cup without a mind perceiving it? Yeah? So those two things are established in relationship to each other. Yeah? But they sure feel like they're independent, don't they? Yeah? They sure feel like they're like miles apart from in our own experience. Yeah? And yet, if they existed that way, how could, you know, if the cup existed as this external thing and my consciousness were, you know, existing in and of itself, if things really existed the way I think of them, how could I perceive anything at all? Because something that's independent is independent of any other factor. Yeah. It isn't affected by any other factor. So if my mind were just here in and of itself, independent, it couldn't be affected by the cup. So no perception could occur. Yeah?
So how do you apply that same understanding to trying to looking for the to
forgetting
the non-existent person,
who's
yourself. How do you apply it to yourself?
Uh-huh. Apply that understanding to yourself.
Same relational, okay. How do you think about that relational dependence in relation to the self?
Well, if you look at the I and the aggregate, you know, the I depends on the aggregate. Yeah. Okay. My I depends on my aggregates, and my aggregates depend on my I in the sense that they're not my aggregates unless there's a person who possesses them. And there's not a person that possesses the aggregates unless there's the aggregates that are possessed. Right? Okay. So they've got to be related to each other. So it's not that there's, you know, here's the body and mind out there, and then there's this person here who's up in heaven somewhere, you know, up in the bardo somewhere, looking down saying, what aggregate shall I take? Not like that. Okay, because the self is imputed in dependence on the aggregates, and yet we say conventionally that the self, you know, clings to the aggregates, or it takes it, appropriates the aggregates. But that doesn't mean that it's outside separate that says, yeah, I want these, they're mine. Yeah, it's strange language, don't you think, to say that the self appropriates? Yeah, the Theravada's translated cling to. That makes much more sense to me. You know, the clung to aggregates. Because that's what we're doing. We're clinging to them. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that kind of informs this was something that, you know, a point that you were making about
that the cup is not unchangeable and my mind is not unchangeable, if these were two unchangeable things, they would never, there would be no meeting, there would be no interaction. So that's really important, and I think it's something that's part of our misperception of reality and our part of our objectifying things as self-existences, that inherent into that is the idea of unchangeability, or that the mere presence has, you know, not affecting the environment and the environment not affecting the perceiver. And so it's a good way to start approaching that and taking a look at it and seeing how these things are interacting, you know, how these are interacting. And that information transfer happens in the changeability. You know. To go into information.
Yeah.
But if you have something like a flat signal, it's just like you mean like that, there's no information being transferred.
Uh-huh.
It's only when the signal goes like this that you hear the voice, right?
Yeah.
You know. So that's part of understanding the interdependent nature, and also it's part of understanding the emptiness. One of the things that it's emptying of is being unchangeable,
mm-hmm.
you know, changelessness.
How do you define information in that sense?
Information is what's communicated. It's, you know, what's communicated, or how you perceive the change is the information. But the change that you perceive, it is the information.
There's a whole thing about the relationship between things being permanent and things being truly existent. And permanence is not the definition of truly existent.
Right.
But if things were truly existent, they would be unchanging and permanent. And so the whole thing, what I heard you saying, tell me if it's correct, is that the process of expressing somebody to information to someone changes the person who's expressing, and the person who's listening when they hear is also changed.
Right. And that happens in every interaction.
Yeah.
Everything changes everything else, and it's just one of those little meditations that you can do to help approach.
Yeah.
How things are different than the way
we perceive. Right. And to me, just this whole thing, like with the earthquake in Chile and how that generated, you know, they were talking about in 1960 how many people were killed in Japan due to a tsunami because of this huge earthquake in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan's like, what, you know, halfway around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so just how things affect each other. Not necessarily, you know, right there at the time, but it can also be after a while. Mm-hmm.
So that just makes me think of the tower practice that we were just doing. And also, Jim, as you may, anyone who knows, he's here, who remembers such a good talk to me. I got to thinking about that in like this, the idea that any encounter, even if there's barely an acknowledgement, I jog and pass by people, and some smile and say hello, and others don't. But they probably know that another person just went by.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to think about that in terms of generating something that makes that encounter meaningful,
yes.
Putting something compassionate out.
Yes.
And that encounter, as minimal though it is, if I put that out, it changes the whole world.
Yep. Yep. That's
it.
Yep. Yep. Very well put. Thank you.
I guess I get a little confused there, because, or maybe a lot, but you know, in the long run, we're trying to visualize everyone as, you know, we do friend, enemy, stranger, and try to see everyone as equally lovable and that can change our perception of everyone. And but then when I go to the cup, I go, well, hey, why don't I have gold there? A cup.
Or
does that make sense? Or I mean, if I'm trying to project, or not project, for maybe projected is the word, or label, everyone is equally lovable, and it's in less of a material designation, but when I come to objects, I think, well, why is that just a cup?
Okay, so you're asking, how come when we come to sentient beings, friend, enemy, and stranger, we can make them, we can change how we perceive them and see them all as equally worthy of affection, but when it comes to a cup, it seems like it's just out there as it is. Well, actually, you know, we might look at the cup and say, ugly cup. Or we might look at the cup and say, attractive cup. And so, you know, by examining that too, why do I say it's ugly? Why do I say it's attractive? Then we can also see that, that that's something that's projected on top of the cup.
Okay, then I think I go one step further and go, well, am I just kind of putting out rose-colored glasses towards...
Towards sentient beings?
Not sentient beings, but like the cup.
Well, I think rose-colored glasses on cups isn't our problem. I think with sentient beings trying to, you know, sometimes when we start to take down the separation between friend, enemy, and stranger, one part of our mind says, well, but that person really is awful. And if for me to see them as lovable, then I have to say what Hitler did was good. Otherwise, I can't love him, and that's not right. Okay, that's what our mind does. Okay? So, you know, is equanimity saying that what Hitler did was okay, and that's the only way I can love him? No. Okay? We're not saying that. To love somebody doesn't mean that all their actions are virtuous. Okay, loving just means that we wish them to have happiness and its causes. Why? Because they're a sentient being like us who wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Yeah, but their actions are something different. So we don't have to like somebody's actions in order to care about them as a sentient being. Yeah, so it's when we're practicing equanimity, we're not whitewashing. Yeah. We're not whitewashing and saying, well, some people are really awful, but I'm just pretending that they're good people for the sake of this meditation. But really, they're awful. No, we're not doing that. Yeah, we're, instead of looking superficially at somebody's actions, we're looking deeper, and that everybody just wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. And in that way, everybody's completely equal.
Maybe I'm getting confused with how I'm merely, when I think of merely labeling something.
Yeah.
I'm being superficial.
Well, with the cup or with the person grasping at comfort or pleasure or any other kind of discrimination is something you can look at in either way.
I mean, if I can say that the cup is beautiful, or I can say the cup is ugly. Okay, that's my labeling process on top of it. It doesn't mean that the cup is either one from its own side. Okay, is that making some sense?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to think about that.
Okay. Yeah.
We talk about things existing in two ways, or two modes, or two aspects, conventional or ultimate nature, which is empty. And so I guess, if I'm correct, you have two ways of looking at that. So you see, if you're perceiving conventional, you see one aspect. If you're perceiving the ultimate, you're perceiving
Yeah. When we say that things have two natures, they have a conventional nature, which is that they're dependently arising. They have an ultimate nature, which is that they're empty. Okay? When you look at an object, with a conventional valid cognizer that is perceiving falsities, then you apprehend the object. But the way it's appearing to you isn't how it exists. Okay? When you look, how does it really exist? You're still looking at the same basis of the object, but how does it really exist? Then you're invoking ultimate analysis, and that's going to see the object of that consciousness is going to be its emptiness. So it's kind of like, yeah, two different perspectives. It's two different cognizers that you use to cognize two different aspects. Yeah? One is the superficial appearance aspect, and the other is how it really exists.
Two ways in which your mind is working, or awareness?
There's two different cognizers. One is like our just conventional mind, that looks superficially, that doesn't analyze how something exists. And when we look, oh yeah, the cup's here, the book is there, this person's here. But then the ultimate analysis is saying, well, the cup exists, but how does it, the cup appears, but how does it really exist? When I search for what is the cup, what is really there that is the cup?
Okay, I think I understand that, but when I start off with, say, the four-point analysis, I'm working from, I'm starting from the point of seeing things as real, or, you know, my seeing things as falsity. And,
and believing that falsity to be true.
Yeah. And how do I, even when I'm doing the four-point analysis, I think I'm still doing that.
Still doing what?
I don't know that I'm switching frequencies or...
Well, I think you're still starting off, you know... I mean, I don't think you have to go immediately. You know, it's not like you switch frequencies immediately and there's, you know, like... those minds are like totally opposite or something. There's no link over process. I think you start with your conventional mind, but then you start questioning, how does that really exist? And that's what that probing awareness is, Rigshe. And then that gets you deeper. Yeah, it's like, okay, this appears to me. You know, oh yeah, there's this cup out there, solid. It's out there, really. You know, there it is. Everybody sees this cup and knows it's a cup, 100%. Yeah? If this doesn't exist, nothing exists because I see it with my eyes. You know, it's real. And then you start saying, well, what is it? Yeah. And then you start looking. Now, it doesn't seem any big deal to look at the cup because we don't have, like, a lot of emotion around the cup, you know. Maybe if it was your, I don't know, precious heirloom upon which your whole livelihood depended, you would have more emotion about it. But, so this works much better, I think, when we look at the self, ourselves, because there's a lot of emotion around ourself. Isn't there? Because our whole life is centered around the notion of I. Everything centers around I. Doesn't it? Everything. You know? Our whole vision of everything centers around the conception of I. So we have a lot of investment in that I. A whole lot of investment. Yeah. So then to start and say, well, you know, I feel like this eye is right here. It's real. It's there. And then to say, well, okay, how does it really exist? What is it really? Yeah. besides just saying I, what is it? It feels like it, the I, the word I is referring to one concrete thing. So what is it? Look for that. Search that. Yeah. And I think that's what makes it so jarring. It's like, wait a minute, my whole life is structured around me. But I can't find me when I look for her. Yeah.
And take that, and how does that support the compassion? Because when I start to even try to imagine that, it's like that feeling of wanting to help goes away with it.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. That's the tension the guy was talking about. What you're doing is, it's not necessary that the feeling of wanting to help goes away, because it isn't that your perceiving emptiness makes the person non-existent. Okay? But actually, if you can see that person as not so solid, you know, as dependent on causes and conditions, then, especially seeing the person, you know, as dependent on causes and conditions, well, then that person's suffering is dependent on causes and conditions, which means if you change the causes, the person's not going to suffer, which means that suffering can be changed, it can be eliminated. So then knowing that actually enhances your willingness to help, because you know that that person isn't stuck in their garbage forever and ever and ever. Yeah, that the garbage is just some caused phenomena. But once those causes are eliminated, then that garbage isn't going to be there. Okay? So I think that's why bodhisattvas, you know, the highly realized bodhisattvas, why they can look at suffering and still feel hopeful. Why they don't get depressed. Because they see that suffering isn't a given.
One of the things about thinking about emptiness, I think the tension between emptiness and compassion, for me, part of it is because of the self-grasping mind, but I think it goes back to what you're talking about, like the nihilist and naturalist think the same thing, which is things either really, really exist or they really, really don't. And our conceptions of compassion at this point are contaminated by our self-interest really a lot. And so we're saying, if I don't have self-interest, how can I have compassion? Because my compassion is contaminated with that self-interest. And by understanding, you know, by loosening that self-attachment and to myself, mm-hmm. and so that myself is not the end result of every action, every thought, and everything, then what else is there, you know? There's the others, you know? And that's when true compassion starts entering into the story.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, we're sort of telling ourselves the analogies of what's out there in the future. But but until we break that chain of self-grasping and even, you know, really have no hope of really experiencing compassion.
Well, I think we still can experience some compassion without realizing emptiness.
Well, yeah, but to be able to really, of course, we feel kindness towards each other, and we feel mm-hmm. love towards each other, and we want to help each other, and we want each other not to suffer on some level.
Mm-hmm.
But to not see those things as being contradictory really is. You have to get to the place where you're not completely changed by your own self.
Yeah. Well, definitely, you know, obliterating that thought of me to which everything is self-referenced, you know, definitely helps with compassion. But, for example, a bodhisattva can enter the path of accumulation without having a realization mm-hmm. of emptiness. So, yeah, we can have compassion and bodhicitta without realizing emptiness. But they're certainly more powerful when we do have a realization of emptiness.
Mm-hmm. I'm just focusing on, you know, what people are saying, well, how can there be emptiness and there be compassion, you know, and I think that that question comes out of the self, you know, the automatic self-grasping.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard to imagine, you know, if I wasn't me having this feeling towards somebody else, what else is there?
If there isn't me having compassion for somebody else. I have compassion. If there's no me, how can I have compassion?